The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yechiel Krish now presents his lecture, How Old is the Universe, Really?
We're talking about science and Torah, and specifically today we're going to talk about the age of the universe, the age of Earth, and it's the biggest problem. It really is the biggest problem in the science and Torah discussion. There's nothing quite as intractable. We have on one hand an Earth that, according to the Torah, looks like it's about 6,000 years old, give or take, exactly 5,783, we'll talk about it, and we have science saying that it's more like 14 billion, and that is not a small argument between buddies. You know, we can't go, hey, let's split the difference. You say 14 billion, I say 6,000, we'll meet in the middle. Somebody do the math for me. Nobody's willing to play that game, so this is probably the most intractable problem in the science and Torah discussion. With that noted, I do want to give a short introduction, and the short introduction is the last thing we talked about last time, which is the absolute most important thing is for a Jew to live as a Jew. And because we interact with science a lot, because we have science in our lives, some of us do it professionally, some of us do it because we like it, some of us do it because we want to learn Torah better, because we want to be able to daven well, as we talked about yesterday. Regardless, we know about science, and because we know about it, it is capable of getting in the way of our divine service. It could get in the way, it could raise questions that cause us not to act as proper Jews. And that's the biggest problem of science and Torah. The biggest problem of science and Torah is when science gets in the way of me doing what I was created for. I was created to serve God. I was created to be a light in this world who does Torah and mitzvahs, who learns Torah and does mitzvahs and makes the world a better place. And if science is getting in the way of that, we need to find a way around it. So today I am going to present to you several approaches, many, many approaches, many that I disagree with. And the reason why I'm presenting many approaches I disagree with, in addition to one that I feel very strongly about, is if along the way you find an approach that speaks to you, that allows you to be the best Jew you can be, and I don't like it, ignore me and take it. Please. If you find a way to reconcile science and Torah on this screen and it's not my favorite, feel free to run with it. Tell your friends, be a Jew. The most important thing is, can we, without throwing science out the window and while living with it, with integrity, can we also live with the Torah with integrity? If you find one, take it. I'm going to reject all the ideas I don't like because I have bad habits, and I'm going to keep the one that I like the best, but please, I'm presenting them all to you with the hope that some of you will say, I hate your idea, but I love that one you had on slide two. And if that's the case, that's also wonderful. That's the introduction. Let's actually get into it a little. Happy 5,783rd birthday, universe. How do I know how old the world is? So the Torah doesn't say how old the world is. The Torah says, Breishis bara elikim eis ha-shamayim ve-eis ha-aretz. At the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. However, the way that I know what the Torah thinks is because I know how to count. We can account for every single year between the creation of the universe and where we are right now in Jewish history. We know where we were. The Jewish people have been around for a while, and before we were around, we knew who our ancestors were too. It's pretty easy to count. I'd like to give you a very brief history of the world according to Torah, just because it's entertaining, because I like a brief history of the world according to the Torah. This is the Torah's position. Adam was born in the year zero. That's when we get Adam and Eve, Adam Arishan. That's in the year zero. Adam dies at the age of 930. According to the Medrash, that's because King David was never supposed to be born in the first place. King David was supposed to die in utero. That would have been an incredible loss to the Jewish people. He gave us the Psalms. He gave us so much of our Torah, so much of the beauty of Judaism, most of our prayers, a lot of them from King David. Adam saw this coming in the future and said, I will give exactly 70 years of my life to King David. And indeed, King David died on his birthday. So King David had exactly 70 years to live. So Adam died at exactly 930 years, giving 70 of his years over to King David. We know that the flood happened in the year 1656. We know what year God flooded the entire world. We know that Abraham, the first Jew, was born in the year 1948. That is 1948, 1,948 years since the creation of the world. I will point out that Abraham was Echad Haya Avram. Avram was the only one who thought what he thought. That did not just mean that Abraham had a unique take on the world. This meant that Abraham was unethical for his time. He was backward for his time. He was stupid for his time. Kiviyachol. Understand what that means. It's not just that idolatry was what people liked. Idolatry was what people thought was ethical. Idolatry was the science of the day. Idolatry was the advancement of the day. And Avram said, I see the evidence of idolatry. I see the academies to idolatry, and I don't care. And you know what they called him? Backwards and wrong and dumb. And they tried to throw him into a furnace, which is actually not what happens at most modern universities. So we have it easier. We really do. But recognize that what is embedded in the Jewish spirit is the idea that Judaism is never really in sync with its time. I do think that there is a perception out there that Judaism recently fell out of sync with world events, and that we used to be, you know, we fit into the ancient world, but we don't work in a modern world. We never fit in. We never fit in. When we lived in places that were very unethical, we were ethical. When we lived in places that were very ethical according to them, what we did wasn't ethical according to them. We've never fit in. So that was Avram. Avram was the year 1948. We became, what is this doing in the Science Torah lecture? I don't know, but it's there. In the year 2332, we were slaves in Egypt. That's when we went down to Egypt to become slaves. The Exodus was in 2448. That's when we left. We got the Torah that same year, only a couple days later. It was 49 days later. We got the Torah at Mount Sinai. That's where we got the oral Torah and the written Torah all together at Mount Sinai. From the year 2448, give or take, because we have to add 40 years, to 2871, we conquered the land of Israel. We had the judges. We had Samson, that super strong guy who lifted up an entire city wall on his shoulders and walked away. We have Devorah, the prophetess warrior, who, by the way, this is a teaser for our session on Sunday. She specifically, in the Song of Devorah, mentions the existence of aliens. She not only mentions their existence, she complains about aliens that didn't do what she wanted them to do. She says, some aliens ignored me and I'm mad at them. So if you want to know whether Torah has aliens in it, ask me on Sunday. We have the warrior prophetess. I know, great. Isn't the Tanakh wonderful? Wonderful. Sunday. Don't miss the session on Sunday. The first temple goes up in the year 2935. There is a second temple. After that, the first temple goes up, the first temple goes down. In between, you have the Purim story. Woo, Purim. After Purim, we have the second temple goes up and the second temple goes down. These are not happy times, but I'm saying it with a smile because we got to keep upbeat. At the end of that period of time, it is the year 3829. The second temple is down. At this point, we take the oral Torah that has been orally transmitted from Sinai and we start writing it down and codifying it. In the year 3949, we close the Mishnah, which is like a kernel, Spark Notes version of the oral Torah. We need to expand it. About 200, 300 years later, we close the Gemara, and that's your Talmud. Anybody come to one of the Talmud sessions yet? That's the year the Talmud closed. From the year 4,800 until around the year 5,252, you have all of your medieval commentaries. That is your Rashi, your Rambam, your Ramban. In the year 5,330, we have the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Jewish law is finally codified by Rav Yosef Kairo and Rav Moshe Isserles, an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi, and they called it the Shulchan Aruch. And then we have the year 5,414, the first Jews come to America. In 5,458, the Baal Shem Tov is born, and as we talked about yesterday, Newton's Principa comes out. This is also the scientific and Hasidic revolution right around the same time as predicted by the Zohar. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please listen to yesterday's lecture. We have Rachmana Litzlan, we have the Holocaust in the year 5,699, the birth of the modern state of Israel in 5,708, and you are here. 5,783, we did it. I can count from the beginning. Please, you can applaud. We did it. That is how I know that the world is 5,783 years old. I want to give you evidence. That is my evidence from the Torah's perspective, that the Torah thinks that's how old the world is. Yeah, so that's a problem. It's going to be a problem. I don't know. He doesn't know. It's a problem. It's going to be a problem. For those listening at home, the slide's pretty funny. The Earth is estimated to be about 4 billion years old, 4.5, but who's counting? The universe is estimated right now to be 13.7 billion years old, according to science. That is a little more than 5,783, a lot more than 5,783. Because I told you in good faith how the Torah knows its age, I would like to very briefly tell you how science knows the age of the world and the universe. This is not a science class. This is not a physics class. I'm really not going to go into detail, but I do think we need some of the basics in order to even have the discussion. For those of you who know this stuff very well, I deeply apologize for butchering your field. And for those of you who don't know it very well, I deeply apologize for oversummarizing something you probably should know more about, but I have like 50 minutes for a lecture, and we've got to learn radiometric dating and red light redshift in a matter of minutes. So bear with me, I'll try my best. This is the very short, we did a very short version of Torah, here's a very short version of the science. How do I know how old the world is? Generally speaking, radiometric dating. You might be familiar with carbon dating. Carbon dating is the ugly younger brother father of radiometric dating. Carbon dating is that anything that was once alive, as long as it lived, was absorbing carbon-14. It's a kind of carbon molecule. Once it dies, it stops doing that. So however much carbon-14 that animal or that thing had while it was alive, a tree, whatever, that's how much it's stuck with. Over time, that carbon-14 is going to decay at a predictable rate. Since I can count how it's going to decay over time, I actually can never figure out when something was born or how long something lived, but I can totally figure out what day it died. And because I can figure out what day it died, I can date how old things are. This is how we know, or how science knows, how old different... this is how we know how old trees are. I mean, we can count the rings, but that's a little archaic. This is how we know how old dinosaur fossils are. This is how they do carbon dating. You may have noticed that the world is not a living thing. It does not absorb carbon-14. You can't carbon date a rock, but you can use radiometric dating, and radiometric dating is quite similar. We find some other isotope, we find some other molecule, some other atom, and we watch it decay over time. The data is astonishingly consistent. You're hearing this from a rabbi on a stage who's about to knock science, but I'm telling you right now that the data in science is very consistent. It's very hard to have a problem with. If you look at the oldest meteorites that we have on Earth, I wrote down the name of it because I always forget, the Canyon Diablo meteorite. That's a good name. Canyon Diablo meteorite. It has the same date on it as approximately the date of lunar rocks, which lines up very nicely with the formation of the world. The lowest levels of the crust that we can get to, the oldest rocks we get to, when we do the radiometric dating on them, no matter what we test, it consistently comes up to 4.5 billion. It's kind of incredible. The science is very consistent across different samples. It looks great. How do we do the age of the universe? Well, there's no carbon out there, and there's also not a lot of rock. There is rock. I guess we could date the rock, but that's not really how it's usually done. The main way that we date the age of the universe is using cosmic, microwave, background, radiation. Four very scary words. What it basically is it's essentially fossilized light. I hate that I'm calling it that. I apologize. But it really is. It's something like fossilized light. What it is that when an object's moving away from us, we call that light redshift. That's when an object's moving away, the light it gives off is called redshift. Astronomers are able to use redshift to deduce how far an object is away from Earth, and the largest observed redshift is something that we call cosmic microwave background radiation. When we look at the cosmic microwave background radiation, that is essentially a cooled remnant of the first light that ever existed in the universe, and we can use that to figure out how long the universe has been around. That is a very quick summary of how we date the universe, but when we sent up a NASA spacecraft to figure it out, they came up with a number that's about 14 billion. The European Science Commission, they sent up a spacecraft, the Planck spacecraft, because the Europeans are always competing with NASA. So they sent up their spacecraft. They came up with a number that is off by like 100 million, so they said they were right. But bottom line, we have very consistent data on how old the oldest light is in the universe, which would suggest we also know the age of the universe to be about 14 billion, or as I put up on the screen, this is a finding from like a year ago. This is quite new. They now think it's closer to 13.7 billion years. I'm going to spend most of my time here focusing on the age of the Earth, and that's simply because of my own ignorance. I'm a biologist by training. I did evolutionary biology. I worked with carbon and radiometric dating, and all of my knowledge of physics is pretty much from undergrad and some time I spent reading the books. So while we will discuss some of the age of the universe, I'm going to be focusing a lot on the age of the Earth. I believe the principles we're going to discuss are largely fungible. I believe they can work just as well for the age of the universe as they can work for the age of Earth. But I do want to do a quick review first. This is a slide from yesterday. It's actually two slides mushed together, if you remember yesterday's lecture. I do want to recall that there are essentially four approaches to the science Torah question. Approach number one is let's havdalah candle the Torah, twist the Torah into a knot. This presupposes that science must be true. Science is accurate, science is bold, science knows what it's doing, and therefore the Torah must be wrong. Wrong. The way you're reading the Torah is wrong. I'm going to take the Torah and twist it into a knot to match the supposition of science. That is one approach. Its major weakness is always going to be that it supposes the primacy of science and supposes the inferiority of Torah, and I think that's a shame. But it's there. There are some approaches that will twist the Torah into a knot. We will have approaches that will twist science into a knot. That's my double helix that looks like it got into a dryer. That double helix down there that's all twisted up, that signifies twisting science into a knot. We will do that too sometimes, and again, not an invalid approach, just one you should be aware of. Sometimes we look at the science and we say, the Torah must be true, so the science doesn't really mean it. The reason why I don't like this is mainly because no scientist likes it. You can't have an honest conversation with someone who has dedicated their entire life to a field by telling them that you think their field fails a logic test. They have a lot of data, and they will stomp all over your face. They absolutely will. So I don't like it as an approach for discussion, because I think that we should assume that science, and as we spoke about yesterday, the Torah values the opinion of science. I don't think science is something that we should be twisting and making fun of or not understanding the proper utility of. I don't like twisting science, but it's an approach. We can twist science till it fits the Torah. The third approach is we bring in Kabbalah and we smash away the whole question. Then yesterday we introduced the fourth approach. The fourth approach is my approach. It's the one I'm going to be championing today. And that is that we need to understand what science does. We need to understand what Torah does. And if every discipline is allowed its space, Torah is allowed to do what Torah does best. And science is allowed to do what science does best without twisting either, you usually can find a happy medium. And that's what we're going to be discussing today, an approach to the age of the universe and the age of Earth that twists science, one that twists Torah, one that uses Kabbalah, and best of all, in my opinion, the one that synthesizes them all together. That is an outline of what we're about to do. Let's start by twisting the Torah into a pretty little Havdalah candle. There are several approaches out there to twisting the Torah to make the Torah's 6 days of creation become 14 billion years or 4 billion years, whether you're talking about the Earth or the universe. There are ways to do it. And some of these ways are in classic commentaries. Some of these ways are in ancient works. Some of these ways literally come from the 13th century. Pretty old stuff. These are not New Age ideas. These are valid ideas in their own context. They are not my personal approach, and I will show you some problems with them. But let me defend them first, because again, as we talked about at the beginning, I'm hoping to show you enough options that if you don't like mine, you'll find your own and be a good Jew. That's the goal here, is to find an approach that works. So let me introduce you to some of the approaches. One of the most classic is that Ki elef shanim beinecha kiyem esmol. King David himself said it. God, 1,000 years in your eyes is like one day. When God says one day, he might mean 1,000 years. The Torah says that each of the days of creation was a day, yom. That's the word I put up on the screen. Yom normally means day. I think it's a 24-hour period. Says King David, not always. Sometimes it's 1,000 years. Okay, are we closer to 4 billion if we make the 6 days? We're not closer. We're not mathematically closer. You might think we're closer, but the fact is the difference between 6,000 and 14 billion and 6 days and 14 billion is infinitesimal. If we had a good calculator and we put both in the calculator, even a very good calculator would give you a zero for both of those division questions. It doesn't get you any closer mathematically. At a point that big, I mean, it does. I don't mean it literally doesn't. In discrete numbers, it gets you closer. But we are really not still. It doesn't help. It doesn't help. If you really want to, I am totally okay with, I think the classical sources are okay with, you making the 6 days of creation each 1,000 years long. That's fine. It's not going to help you in science. It's also not going to help you in Torah, because the Torah doesn't say 1,000 years, it says a day. But be aware, we can mess with days a little bit. There is the approach of the Tiferes Yisrael. It's in the Drashas Orach Chaim. It's a classic. It was mentioned to the Lubavitcher Rebbe many times in many letters. It's brought up to him and he rejects it, but it's a known drasha. It's from the Tiferes Yisrael, a major commentary on Mishnayos. He brings up this point. It's also brought in the Ramban. It's brought in Rabbeinu Bechaya. These are old medieval sources who say that God didn't make the world just once. He made the world and destroyed the world several times, maybe seven times, up to seven times. We don't know exactly which one we're up to. We might be on the second cycle, the sixth cycle. We might be living on the seventh. This is a bit of a debate, but God made and destroyed the world repeatedly, and that Bereishis Bara Elokim, Esa Shemayim Ve'esa Aretz, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is several cycles into this cycle of destruction. This is a Kabbalistic approach. It is certainly not the Pshat. It's not the simple understanding of the Chumash. It's not the simple understanding of the universe. But if we have multiple old worlds beneath this world, we can imagine a world that begins with creation. That is a world that is built on a 4-billion-year-old surface that has 6,000 years we've been tracking since then. Such an idea does exist. This was really brought into its own by Rav Aryeh Kaplan with the help of Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko. Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko was a student of the Ramban, Nachmanides. He lived in the 13th century. He was brilliant, as all of those people back then were. They were a smart group of people. They really were, especially the Ramban's students. Yitzchak of Akko had this idea. To be perfectly honest with you, Yitzchak of Akko didn't really have this idea. Yitzchak of Akko has one detail of this idea. Rav Aryeh Kaplan in his book uses Yitzchak of Akko, the Tiferes Yisrael, and several other sources to build the following argument. But we're going to call it, for our purposes, the Yitzchak of Akko argument. It goes like this. If there are seven cycles of existence of the world before the modern world, and if each of those cycles is going to contain 7,000 years, which is the assumption is that 1,000 years is going to be one day of the 6 days of creation. Each of those 1 days converts to 1,000, so we have 7,000 years. 7,000 years in seven cycles. So 7 times 7,000, and then we take Yitzchak of Akko, who says every one of those years were God years, where one day equals 1,000 years. So we have to add also 365,000, give or take. I wasn't precise, actually. 365,200 and something, because, you know, solar years is not exactly 365. But work with the rough math. The rough math will come out. 7 times 7,000 times 365,000 will get you 18 billion, which is a little disappointing because not science thinks the world's 14 billion, but it's closer. It's definitely closer than 6,000 years. This is an old approach. This is from the 13th century. Yitzhak Avako in the 13th century thought the world was 18 billion years old. He was the only one, but he thought it. There is room to do this using Kabbalah. The major problem with both of these approaches, the Tiferes Yisrael and Yitzhak Avako, is remember we talked about the Shulchan Aruch in our rundown of Jewish history? The way that Jewish law works is that there were a lot of big ideas that went into Jewish law, a lot of smart ideas, a lot of holy ideas. Once the Shulchan Aruch was written, it no longer is acceptable to accept those other ideas in practice. So if there is an opinion in an early source that says that I can do something, and Shulchan Aruch says, I'm not allowed to do that thing, I'm not allowed to do it because the final decision, the final arbiter of Jewish law was Rav Yosef Cairo and Rav Moshe Isserles. That's it. It doesn't really go from there. There is a final arbiter of Kabbalah. And as a matter of fact, he lived at the same time in the same place as Rav Yosef Cairo. At the same time that Rav Yosef Cairo was living in Tzfat, there was a Kabbalist named the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and he is considered universally to be the final arbiter of Kabbalah, which means good Kabbalistic ideas that existed before the Arizal are inapplicable if the Arizal does not accept them. The Arizal, when he encountered these ideas, said that indeed the world was created and destroyed many times, but only in spirituality, that the physical world was created exactly 5,783 years ago, 783 years ago, thank you. I think I said six at some point. Somebody go edit the podcast. somebody edit for me. Since the Arizal said definitively that these prior worlds were spiritual, not physical, we don't really have permission to use this old Kabbalah anymore. The final arbiter of Kabbalah tells us that indeed, the spiritual worlds could be billions of years old. If you go up to the world of Atzilus, you are a Bria, you might find that those worlds are billions of years old. The rock we have here is only 6,000 years old, give or take, according to the Arizal. And that means that we're unable really, honestly, to use these Kabbalistic approaches. Gerald Schroeder is very popular in Eish HaTorah circles. He's written some fantastic books. He's a scientist himself, and he's written some fantastic books reconciling science and Torah. He has an approach that I also want to introduce you to, although I'm not personally an enormous fan. I'm a fan of his, not of the approach. The approach, I'll tell you its problems, but I do want you to be aware of it, and that is that when you look at nucleosynthesis, that's the time when matter initially formed, between the relationship between that and the time that we have today, the relationship that a physicist will tell you is that the ratio is about 1 to 1 trillion. So one moment now is equivalent to 1 trillion of those moments, 1 day to 1 trillion. It's a 1 to 1 trillion ratio, which means that if God were to send us a pulse every second from creation, we would see it every trillion seconds. Let's do the math. Adam was created in the middle of he's created on the sixth day, but since he's created on the sixth day and the sixth day hasn't ended yet, there are 5.5 days of creation prior to Adam. Dr. Schroeder wants to say that starting from Adam, we start counting normal chronological time like we count it, but prior to Adam, we're counting cosmic time. So that means 5.5 days of creation are going to have a 1 to 1 trillion ratio to them, and after that, we can count the normal 6,000. What happens if you do that? Well, let's try it. 5.5 days times 1 trillion gives us 5.5 trillion days. That math, even I can do. 5.5 trillion days. We then divide those days by 365 because we need to form years. How many years do we get? 15 billion years. That's close. That's not bad at all. Not bad at all. It's pretty good. Right. So be aware. There is a way to do this math. I'll tell you why I don't like it. And as long as we're here, I do want to mention, I have a very dear friend back in Pomona where I live, also a brilliant scientist who spent a lot of time reconciling science and Torah. One of the people who the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, authorized to be involved in resolving science and Torah, his name is Dr. Alex Polterak. I spent some time talking to him before preparing these lectures, and he told me that he has a theory too. You should look it up online, look up his name, you'll find his theory that involves collapse of a wave function, involves quantum mechanics, and he also comes to a similar conclusion where he can make this work using quantum mechanics. I want to tell you why I don't love approaches that use quantum mechanics and theoretical physics or even practical physics to answer questions in the Torah, and it's just a personal qualm. I don't really believe that when God said he made the world in 6 days, he meant you'll understand if you know theoretical physics. I think that's unlikely. I think it's unlikely, God. I'm writing a Torah for the ages, for the average person. Rashi says a 5-year-old can understand it, Ben Chamish Lemikra, and I'm writing this Torah for the ages for 5-year-olds. One note, though, it does take a background in theoretical physics to fully understand what I mean. I don't think so. I just don't buy it. That doesn't mean that it doesn't work, and once again, if it works for you, please take it. But it doesn't work for me. I can't imagine a Torah where God says, I made the world in 6 days, but I meant 14 billion years. It doesn't sound like him. That's not my God. I don't know. That's my problem with these physics-based approaches. There is another approach, and this is the epoch approach, and I call it that because it's the way it was presented to me when I was in Yeshiva University. I'm a graduate of Yeshiva University. After our first introduction to biology class, they brought a rabbi in the room, one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, and his job was to undo all the damage that our biology teacher had done, because he taught us evolution, he taught us the age of the universe, and this is Yeshiva University. So in some schools, if you've been there, you know, some schools, the approach is to teach the science, some is to teach the Torah. At Yeshiva University, they teach the science and then come in to bring somebody in to do damage control. So he came in to do damage control, and in his damage control lecture, which was mandatory, you failed the class if you didn't attend the damage control lecture. This was forced on me. So I'm sitting there attending the damage control lecture, and the rabbi explains to me that 6 days does not have to be 6 days, it can be 6 eras, 6 epochs, 6 periods of time. There was the era of the sun, moon, and stars, the era of the growth of trees, the era of the evolution of mammals, and that we can split the 6 days into arbitrary periods of time. This is not just his approach, this is probably the most prominent approach. A lot of the approaches I've given you are sort of hard to find in books. This one is the layperson approach. You ask the average person, how do you deal with this? They go, 6 periods, 6 epochs, 6 periods of time. I have some issues. I want to give you some approximate scientific dates to work with. And this is according to science. According to science, the Big Bang would have been about 3.8 billion years ago. Earth, about 4.5 billion years ago. You know that already. Trees, about 400 million years ago. Million, not billion. The sun, 4.6 billion years ago, right before the Earth. Fish and birds, depends on whether it's a fish or a bird, but they're made on the same day in creation. So fish, about 530 million years ago. Birds, about 60 million years ago. Mammals, about 210 and million years ago. And humans, about 7 million years ago. These are the scientific estimates. So if you would like to use the epoch approach, let's lay down some ground rules. Let's say that since we're being generous and since we're friends, that one day does not have to be 1,000 years. I'll let you make it as much time as you like. You can have billions, you can have millions. You pick. You can have as much time as you want. I'm also inherently in doing that allowing you to take a non-literal take on the word yom, which is a big allowance. The word yom in the Torah always means 24-hour periods, but I'm allowing you to not just make it a non-24-hour period, I'm allowing you to make it any amount of time you want for God. Which period of time would you like to make it that would work for the 6 days of creation? Would you like to do, I don't know, what's anybody have quick with math? What's 14 billion divided by 6? Would you like to split it up that way? Here's the problem. I put up a map here of the time that would have to pass between each day according to science. And this is assuming that the first day is the time of the Big Bang, and this is assuming that the sun is going to actually be a negative equation, so you'd have to flip that block if you were really doing this right. But for our purposes, here's what comes out. For our purposes, between the Big Bang and the creation of the world, that is from day one to day two, from God making light to making the heavens and the earth, you would need yom, the word day, to mean 9 billion. Fantastic. From now on, day means 9 billion. On day one, it was 9 billion. On day two, 18 billion. Uh-oh. We just went too far on day two. We're in big trouble. Well, that's okay. Science would actually like day two to three, the day between when the Earth was made and when trees were made. That's a period of time that should be 4.1 billion. That's from the formation of Earth to the first trees. Okay, now what does day mean? 4.1 billion, what happened to 9 billion? Oops. Moving right along, we get to day three. From day three to day four, that's from trees back to the sun. Same problem we had before. Trees to sun is actually a negative equation because the way science understands it, the sun came first. But allow it for right now. Now we're in 4 billion again. We're getting the number 4 billion, right? About 4.2 billion. From day two to day four to five epoch, that's the sun until the creation of birds and fish, another 4 billion years. 4 billion's looking like a winning number. But birds and fish to mammals, 300 million. Whew. So what's day mean? Nothing? Meaning I'm willing to accept the possibility that day does not mean 24 hours for the thought experiment. I'm willing to let you make it whatever you want to make it. But it is very difficult to say that from verse to verse, in two verses next to each other, day goes from meaning 9 billion to 300 million. That's hard to imagine. It's not an honest look at the Torah. I think it lacks some integrity. I think it's hard to say honestly that one day meant 9 billion in one verse and that the next verse he uses that same word again to mean 300 million. That's hard to imagine, but that's what that would look like graphically. Do you buy it? I don't. I don't buy it. I think it's dishonest. And by the way, you know who agrees with me? Almost every atheist scientist. They will tell you that there's no way in the world the Torah didn't think that it was making 6 days. I mean, it's kind of simple. It's kind of simple that when God says 6, he probably means 6. These are ways to twist the Torah. There's a much bigger problem, though. The biggest problem is this. You guys remember the Ten Commandments? Yeah? Okay, good. In the Ten Commandments, it says you have to keep Shabbos. Does God say, keep Shabbos, that's the Ten Commandments? No, he explains himself. He says, keep Shabbos because in 6 days God made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and then he rested on the seventh. Therefore, you do it too. So if God really made the world in 14 billion years, Shabbos is not for another 14 billion years. Meaning, if you want to say yom doesn't mean yom sometimes, great. But God himself says, you are keeping Shabbos, you are working for 6 days and resting on the seventh because that's exactly what I did. So he's saying that's exactly what I did, or we need to be keeping Shabbos a lot less often, right? That's a bit, I think that's an insurmountable problem. I think it's insurmountable because the Torah itself is testifying, and by the way, we testify every single Shabbos. When we keep Shabbos, it says in the Talmud that somebody who keeps Shabbos is proving that God made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh because I just worked for 6 days and rested on the seventh. The keeping of Shabbos is itself a proof of what the Torah really thinks. The Torah really thinks 6 days. And I don't think any approach is going to get around that problem. That is a real hard problem to get around. There's another one you should be aware of, and that is that in our legal documents, probably our most binding and most terrifying legal document is the get, the divorce document. By the way, says in the Talmud, I didn't make up this joke, this is a Talmudic joke, and it's not a joke, but it's funny, why in the Torah is divorce discussed before marriage? Because nobody would enter a marriage if there was no way out. That's in the Talmud. You don't get in what you can't get out of. What can I tell you? God forbid everybody should have happy and long marriages. When it comes to divorce documents, we have a rule in Jewish law that applies equally to secular law. And this is a rule, if you ask any contract lawyer, they'll tell you, don't put things in documents if you don't have to put things in documents. Better to leave it out because somebody's going to pick at that, and that's where the document's going to fail. We have this idea in Jewish law, too. If you can leave something out of a get, we generally do. Same thing with a ksuba. If you can leave things out of Jewish legal documents halachically in Jewish law, we leave them out. And yet, for generations, we've been writing at the top of every Jewish legal divorce that this is X number of years since the creation of the world. That's in our binding legal documents. And that's something to be aware of. The Torah and our tradition takes it so seriously that we're not afraid to put it in a binding legal document. All of our binding legal documents have this many years since the creation of the world. And I don't want us to forget logic, because logic does matter. God probably means what he says. That's the biggest problem with twisting the Torah. He probably means what he says. And I also don't want you to forget integrity, which is that virtually no commentary, except for Yitzchak of Akko, virtually no commentary ever assumed that the world was less than 6,000 years old until it became uncomfortable to go to work with that philosophy. And that should make you suspicious. It is. I mean, that should make you a little uncomfortable. The fact that we only started twisting the Torah when it became awkward to live with its literal reading does suggest we're being dishonest about the twist, right? It'd be one thing if we had many, many early commentaries who all put the date at 14 billion, and now we're coming out and bringing this to the front to show the Torah matches science. We're not doing that. We're humiliated by our Torah. We're embarrassed by it. It's hard to explain to our friends. So suddenly we're getting twisty. That lacks integrity. It's an approach that lacks integrity. And I think that's something to remember when twisting Torah. So let's twist science. Let's twist science. I put a bunch of words up there that are impossible to understand, but by the time I'm done talking, you will understand them. I want to tell you a little bit about how science works. There are two ways to do experimental science, extrapolation and interpolation. Here's how they work. Let's say that I know how a compound will work at 1 degree, and I know how that compound will act at 100 degrees. I can then decide how that compound will act. Let's do the whole thing. 1 to 100 degrees. I want to do extrapolation first. Excuse me. I know how the compound acts from 1 to 100 degrees. Every degree, I know how it changes. I can guess what it will do at 101 degrees. And I can guess what it will do at 0 degrees. The further I go out, the less reliable my data. If I have a nice linear line, I can probably guess that it's going to be consistent for a long time. But just because I know what this compound does between 1 and 100 does not by any means mean that I know what it does at 1,000 degrees or 10,000 degrees. The further I get out, the less reliable my data. There's another way to do science, interpolation. Interpolation is that I know what the compound does at 100 degrees, and I know what it does at 1 degree, so I'm going to guess what it does at 50. This is much more reliable science. Since I know the ends, I can infer the middle. All dating science, including the universe stuff, and especially the Earth stuff, is largely an act of extrapolation. That is, that I know what compounds are doing right now. I know how radioactive decay works right now, and if you're following science, I know it in a very small period of time, about 300 years out of 14 billion. So I have a very small window of what I know, and I'm extrapolating back billions of years from a window that I can identify as a very small window. That is traditionally not great science. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's something that is shaky on scientific grounds. We don't love extrapolation in science. So we could say that this science is not as valid as other forms of science because it's an extrapolation. I'll give you another one. Antecedent versus a consequent. This is called a logical fallacy. You can write this down in your long list of logical fallacies. I'm allowed to take an antecedent and figure out a consequent, but not a consequent to an antecedent. I'll give you an example that makes it real easy to understand the real hard words. Shout out the answer if you know it. 4 divided by 2. There we go. It's not a trick question, I promise. I wouldn't do that to you. I'm your friend. 4 divided by 2 is 2. Okay, that is an antecedent to a consequent. Solid. There's nothing else it could be. Let's say I have two. How'd I get there? Infinite possibilities. Infinite possibilities. It could have been anything that can get me to two. And since I have an infinite number of numbers, anything can get me to two. That's how math works. An infinite number of ways to get to the consequent. So it is considered a logical fallacy to say that because I'm looking at something now, I know for sure where it came from. Whereas it is not a logical fallacy to say, if I know where something started, I can figure out where it will go. All of the dating science that we use, whether it's the Earth or the universe, is a logical fallacy by definition. It is taking a consequent and using it to try to guess at an antecedent, and that is usually a logical fallacy. I'm twisting science. I told you I was going to, but I want to show you how it's done. There's also a lot of stuff missing from our sample. As we mentioned earlier, if we adopt the scientific model that the universe is 14 billion years old and that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, we are observing Earth for a period of time that is a speck in that. We have been observing it actively for about 300 years and with carbon dating for like 70, like 100 years maybe. So we have about 100 years of data to identify this period of time. In that 100 years, we know how radioactive isotopes have decayed. We know how carbon-14 leaves living things over a period of observation of about 100 years. Who's to say that's what it's been doing for billions of years? We're not sure at all. And as a matter of fact, we have reason to wonder whether it has been, because we don't know what atmospheric conditions were like or what catalysts existed in the atmosphere or in the sea in early Earth. So you can imagine a world, if anybody here knows their chemistry, we have a biochemist in the front of the room. If I put a catalyst on the left side of an equation, that can change everything about the right side of the equation. You can have an equation that works perfectly in chemistry. All I need is just the wrong ingredient on this side, and I can shift the whole result on the right side. What could be, and what we simply don't know, is what we don't know everything that was there in early Earth. Since we don't know everything that was there, we can't be completely sure that carbon has been decaying consistently over hundreds of millions of years. We can't be completely sure that a radioactive isotope decays consistently over billions of years because we don't know what else was on the left side of the equation. We're missing catalysts. We have a very small sample window. I hate doing this, and I hate doing this because this is how you get up here and twist science. And I don't like twisting science because I love science. But once again, if twisting science works for you, please take it and run with it. The reason why I don't like it is because I know science, I love science, I've dedicated a lot of my life to understanding science, and the evidence is good. The evidence is really good, and the evidence is really reliable, and it's true. There are logical fallacies, and it's true. There's reasons why this is less reliable science than, say, we would never be able to give this as a drug. This would never get FDA approval, you should be aware. That's according to everybody. No scientist will tell you that we know the age of the universe, the age of the Earth, well enough to get through an FDA trial, which, according to some people, is an exceedingly low bar, right? Depends on who you're talking to. We do not know this well enough to prescribe a medication. That is clear. However, we do know it pretty well. This stuff's been done well, and the science is good, and the science works. You know when the science really works? In the short term. I believe it sometimes. When they go to the Temple Mount, and you know there are some people in the world, unfortunately, right now, who believe that the Jews have no right to the land of Israel, and we go to the Temple Mount, and we find an old potsherd, and we date it to exactly the time we were there, and it has our names on it, we use this as proof that we've been in Israel for a while. I don't want to throw that out, because it's an extrapolation. I like the science, so I don't like this approach, but if you like this approach, it's yours. I want to offer a fourth solution. What if we didn't twist science or Torah? What if we just go back to our fundamental principles, which is that science and Torah are telling us different stories? The Torah is telling us what happened, absolutely. God tells us the truth, and he means it. And when he says day, he's not joking. Day, haha, I met billions. No, he means day. He means 6 days, he means 6,000 years, and God is giving us a Torah that we can practically use that doesn't require theoretical physics or Kabbalah or twisting ourselves into a pretzel to solve. And science is correctly analyzing the world. How do you match that? You can raise your hand, but you don't have to. Who here believes in the splitting of the sea? That God split the sea when we left Egypt? Good number of people, okay. And those of you who didn't raise your hands, you're probably like me. If I'm at a lecture, I never raise my hand. It doesn't matter. There's a certain personality where you just don't raise your hand. So I assume most of us believe that God split the sea. Who here believes in water chemistry, that it's true? Me too, yeah. I know a lot of you don't know water chemistry well enough to know if you believe in it, but it's the reason why when you turn on your sink, it doesn't go up. I mean, you trust water chemistry. You're drinking it. Hydrogen bonds, yeah? How'd that happen? How? Science violates Torah. Science violates Torah. God says he split the sea. I know seas can't split. It's not possible. And even if you'll tell me a tsunami can make a sea split, it also says in the Torah that they walked on dry land by a basha. A tsunami can't dry the land beneath you. And also, it's an opportunistic tsunami, right? The moment the Egyptians are about to catch us, tsunami. That is not something science can explain. So why do you believe in the splitting of the sea? It's an argument between science and Torah. What's the answer that any logical person would give? This doesn't take a science or Torah degree. What's the answer? Tell me. It's a miracle. So what does this miracle break water chemistry? Does this miracle mean hydrogen bonds aren't real? Does this miracle mean that science is wrong? No, this miracle means science is right, but God has the right to break it, and we believe God sometimes breaks nature. Science describes nature in its steady state when God is not miraculously breaking it, and the Torah frequently describes God miraculously breaking nature. What can we do with that background? Because, by the way, most of us already believe it. That's why it's so powerful. Most of us already believe in the possibility of miracles and in the science and the steady state of the world. Let's see what we can do with it. If you leave the world alone, if God had not miraculously, from Big Bang left the world alone, it would have taken 14 billion years to make this planet. That's what I think. That the world, the universe in its steady state, without any divine intervention, without miracles, that's how long it takes to take basic matter and turn it into a practical world and make it into a JLI conference. I believe that takes exactly that amount of time. And I believe that if you take a rock like the Earth and you leave it alone in 4.5 billion years, it would make an Earth that looks like our Earth. It's not how God did it. He did a miracle. He didn't do it that way. He did it in 6 days. God's very fast. He's incredibly fast. He can move a lot faster than science can move when it's in the steady state, but that doesn't mean that the science isn't true. The science is describing what would have happened had God not done it differently. How do I know God did it differently? The one who did it told me. The one who did it wrote in the Torah, I know it's supposed to be this way, but I made miracles. Bereishis bara Elokim. God made the world, not nature, right? God made the world. God invented the world. He did it at his own speed, and it goes a lot faster. Let me give you a quick example. I flew here from California, but I had to stop in Dallas because JLI couldn't get me a direct flight. Maybe next year, guys. So I went from New York all the way to California, and as I went from New York to California, I don't know how long it would have taken. Let's say it takes 5 hours, because I'm guessing. I had to stop. I have no idea how long the trip was. Let's say it's a five-hour trip. Let's say 5 hours. Let's say that God decided that because I'm such a good guy and I got a good presentation to give, he wants to give me a hand, and he teleports me. I get to California instantly. Is the trip from New York to California no longer 5 hours? It still is. He just did it faster. Why would he leave that evidence for me so that I know how to do it myself? That is, I'm telling you a fourth point of view, which is that God made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, and that the world is only about 6,000 years old, but he left in the world all of the evidence for how to make a world over the course of billions of years using nature. Why would he leave it there? So that I can use it. The reason that he created everything. God created everything for us to use, either to make humanity better, to make our religion better, to make the world better. God left the instructions for how to make a world accurately in billions of years right there. Meanwhile, he did it a little bit faster, actually a lot faster. In order to do this, you don't have to reject any geoscience. Geoscience works. Radiocarbon dating works. All of these systems work. However, that's not how God did it. He left an old world here. I know that sounds like a theory you've heard before, but it's a little bit different. He left a world here that is going to look old scientifically so that I can figure out how to do science from it. Why would I want to do that? We have fossils. I love fossils. I love dinosaurs. That's a really cool one over there. By the way, I was the person who broke the Brontosaurus story. Do you remember when you were little kids there was a Brontosaurus and then they got rid of him and said he was the Apatosaurus? I broke the story that Brontosaurus was back. I'm very proud of that. It was my greatest accomplishment. Thank you. Yes, I was the one who broke the Brontosaurus' backstory. Since then, it's probably gone again. Science is awful. But, you know, for a period of time, I had the Brontosaurus. I look at a fossil. Let's use the four approaches on fossils very quickly. Approach number one, we can twist Torah. Why are there fossils there? Because the Torah is really billions of years old, and there were dinosaurs walking the earth at the period of time science said. Use your Kabbalah. Use whatever approach you like from those first slides. I can twist science. If I twist science, I say that that's not really the case, that these dinosaurs are very young bones, that I don't really know how to date things, and it's an extrapolation. Those dinosaurs were chilling with Adam in the garden. Adam probably wrote a dinosaur. Eve probably wrote a brontosaurus. This was the way things were done during the period of time in creation. It's just a very new world, and the radiometric dating, the carbon dating, is wrong. Let's do the Kabbalah approach. The world is there were dinosaurs in one of the first iterations, and they're still underground because there's been multiple Shemitahs, multiple seven-year periods building on each other. Let's do the fourth one, though. What's the fourth one? The approach that I'm introducing here. God left the dinosaurs there, left the fossils there, so I would know how fossilization works, and I would know how radiometric and carbon dating works. Why would God want me to know how carbon dating works? Why would he leave evidence for me that I can carbon date that works really far back? I'll give you a couple answers. I told you one already. It helps me date ancient artifacts. Very useful. The whole reason we know how to date ancient artifacts and prove that the Jewish people have a claim to the land of Israel is because of paleontology. We learned that from studying old bones. So without this science, without God leaving this evidence, I wouldn't be able to prove that the Jews were on the Temple Mount at one point. But I'll give you some other ones. Do you know we use radiometric dating of coral to figure out sea level rise to help evacuate communities when they're going to drown in rising sea levels? We predict almost everything regarding climate change using a form of radiometric dating. We are saving the world, saving lives right now using the evidence that God left behind in dinosaur fossils. I'll give you another one. Radiocarbon tracers are used in toxicology and medicine all the time. You think they invented it in medicine and put it on the dinosaurs? They invented it in the dinosaurs and put it back in medicine. There are people whose lives are being saved right now as we speak because God left the evidence for how to carbon date in old life forms on the planet. It would be worthwhile leaving it even if that's not how he did it, because I can then use science to derive first principles, and from first principles, I can make the world a better place. Let me do one with evolution real quick with the time we have left. Evolution. I have a lot of evidence of the evolution of the species. This is not the evolution talk. It would take a whole lecture, but just very quickly. I have evidence of the evolution of the species. I can twist Torah and say the Torah really means everything evolved. I can twist science and say science doesn't really mean everything evolved, right? I can use Kabbalah. I can hide in the higher spheres and things evolved the way they evolved. What about the fourth approach? In the fourth approach, God left in creation evidence of where prior species came from so that I would know how evolution works in theory, although that's not how he did it. He made species individually, but he created speciation, which I can see right now, microevolution, which I can watch now, and evidence of prior evolution, which didn't happen but could have happened and would have happened had the world been that old. And why would he leave that there? Because I can use it. I'll tell you a personal story, and with that we'll end. One of the scientists at the university where I work, his name is Dr. Sean Brady. You can look him up. He's brilliant. Sean Brady has recently put out a synthetic antibiotic. It's in like phase one trials now, so it's early on, but he put out a synthetic antibiotic. The problem was, you know where most antibiotics come from? Bacteria. They hate each other. Bacteria can't stand each other. So bacteria, over the years, have developed ways of killing other bacteria. So bacteria have antibiotics that kill other bacteria. A lot of our antibiotics come from finding how bacteria best kill their neighbors. Problem is that most of these antibiotics are hidden in something called biosynthetic gene clusters. This one's just for our biochemist. They're hidden in something called biosynthetic gene clusters. We can't isolate them. We can't get them out of the bacteria. Sean Brady had an idea. We know how bacteria evolved over the course of billions of years. I put it in quotes. But we know how bacteria evolve. He put that into a computer algorithm. The algorithm calculated how a bacteria hypothetically would have evolved an antibiotic. He synthesized it, and soon it's going to be treating humans. Had we not known, had God not left the exact instructions for how species evolve in species that didn't evolve, we'd be missing antibiotics from our market right now. We're literally making drugs out of the evidence that God left in the world. This fourth theory allows you to embrace science, make science part of your life. It allows you to study science with integrity and at the same time sacrifice nothing in the Torah. God specifically left science here for us to study. It's right, a large amount of it's right, maybe even close to all of it's right, the basic principles. They might all be true. We don't have to knock science at all, and we also don't have to knock Torah at all. Torah tells us what God did. Science tells us what God could have done, leaving us clues that will help us make the world a better place through science itself. So the question being asked here, I'm just going to say your question louder. Yeah, the question being asked here is that the Torah doesn't seem to be a history book. It leaves a lot of things out. Why do I need the Torah to be literally telling me the dates of things? Is that more or less the question? Absolutely. First of all, you're totally right. The Torah is milashon hayra'ah. The word Torah means a teaching book. It is not a history book. Large areas are left out, as you note correctly. Abraham is born in the year 1948. So that's 1,948 years that we know almost nothing about. And certainly we don't know much about the land of Egypt during that time. At the same time, it is also a book of law. And you might remember our slide about Shabbos. Because of our slide about Shabbos, in the book of law, God says, I'm telling you to work 6 days and rest on the seventh because I worked 6 days and rested on the seventh. For things like that, we're kind of stuck. So you're right. If the Torah doesn't match history perfectly, I have no problem at all, because the Torah is not a history lesson. But every now and then the Torah says, I literally mean I did something, and then we do have to reconcile.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.